No insult absorbed. Eleanor was able to report, as she routinely did, day by day, year after year, summing up the preceding 24 hours, that she and Sarah had once again gloried in a day of delightful retirement. In the unrivaled world of private life and in the journal, that book whose publication is confined to heart and hearth, there is no higher court. Life lived, life described, the bits and pieces of the day collected, vignette by vignette, and thus life affirmed. More than enough. Send the visitors off to the hand. Light the candles in the dressing room. Curl up for a bit of Rousseau, Mary Carroll having made up the fire, also snug. The system is the thing, as arm in arm the two of them walk the home circuit, pausing to consider the placement of the carnations, the question of an addition to the shrubbery, the utter impossibility. The 50 years have passed already in the succession of these celestial, glorious days, these heavenly evenings. Winter now, back in St. Paul, the ladies tucked away in my notebooks as they were cold nights in their dressing room, curtains drawn, the fire glowing, their fire in the 18th century, mine here in the 21st. I'm still reading Montaigne. I seem to feel I have to prepare to visit his tower. I can't just show up in Bordeaux as I did in Llangollen, bulk up on the essay, marginal notes in the Donald M. Frame biography, more notes on the recent books by other people writing about Montaigne. One of the oddities or inevitabilities of the reading life is that, like every aspect of human habit, food, clothes, design, it has its fashions. During the latter-day American Belle Époque, the era of our prideful assurance over having won the Cold War, the self-regarding age when Donald Trump's little hands began shellacking so much real estate with gold, it seemed everyone was reading or intending to read Proust. I was intending to. Books about reading Proust became popular in the 1980s and 1990s. How Proust Can Save Your Life, The Year of Reading Proust. The jeweled canvas of the earlier Belle Époque was the mirror of our own garish surface, one world winking at another. This period of Proustophilia coincided with our own entre-deux-guerres. How shockingly brief that Pax Americana was, from the fall of the Berlin Wall in October 1989 to the fall of the Twin Towers in September 2001. We had the heady illusion of winning, being on top, running the show. The end of history? That idea floated around for a while in the absurd arrogance of the age. The end of history came to its own shattering end, of course. The pause between the world wars, 1918 to 1939, when Proust's masterpiece was composed and published, was a period considerably longer than our own age of glee or indifference. Or was it just self-indulgence? Their 21 years to our 12. Whether it was 9/11 or later, the economic meltdown and recession, suddenly, it seems sudden, with the crash of our illusions, stylish readers were swapping out Proust for Montaigne, and books about reading the essay began to take the place of those about reading In Search of Lost Time. Why Montaigne? Why now? I asked you that when I started all this. You were still here to ask, across the yellow kitchen table. Not that you believed in answering such questions. That's why you're writing this, to find out. You were the real reader, pitch-perfect ear, cunning combination of humility and boldness, responding to the page before you. Starkly independent mind, a gallant reader, I'd say now, leaving clippings on my desk, sending me links on email, pursuing any question or curiosity I mentioned at the yellow kitchen table. My research fellow, your post-it note on the clipping from the 25th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution in Prague. Dearest, what about how leisure might fit in with the Cold War? A connection? Discuss. Maybe Montaigne appeals to this age because he retired. That word again. You thought I might have a point there. He had left the world of power and command, sequestered himself in his tower to investigate the furnishings of his mind. Individual consciousness was his subject, not the sweep of his tumultuous era. Yet his was an age of terror and cruelty, crying out for explanation, for a big-picture narrative of its seismic divisions. Whereas Proust's world floated on the airless steadiness of the cork-lined room where in shadow he spun his vast magnificence. In times of peace, the age itself is the story, leisurely with intrigue, gossip, affairs of state, affairs of love. Busy, busy, busy with its social self, making massive formal shapes. In times of terror, like Montaigne's, like ours, we readers, seek instead the sane, singular voice, alone with its thoughts, maybe to assure ourselves that sanity does exist somewhere, and the self, the littleness of personhood, is somewhere alive, taking its notes, and that this matters. We know the awful part, the sweep of history's cruelties. We want the singular voice, abiding. This is why a little girl keeping a diary in an Amsterdam attic is the voice of the Holocaust. Details tossed into the shoebox of the mind, fragments, not a regal story riding its narrative arc, just a bunch of snapshots never amounting to a shape, but too tender to be tossed. Something like that, darling? In this age of terror, and the terror of terror, I've joined the ranks of those reading Montaigne, the sane man in his insane world, a man alone in a room with words, not sorting out his world, sorting his mind. My reading isn't scholarship, just picking up a scent in the air, following it. An attempt to find, across the maw of our distant centuries, some kind of explanation for the kinship I feel. Not just kinship, some kind of help. Call it solace. Montaigne was a reader himself, that's one thing. His essays are studded with quotations, especially when he first started his project. He intended to follow the Stoic model, doing philosophy to learn how to die. Over the kitchen table, you said that was when he was just fooling around, showing off, trying to be a writer. That was when he was something of a pedant. You can't learn to die, you said. You just die. Tough reader, you always were. So what's the difference between writing the big picture, Proust, and collecting small takes, Montaigne? A question we batted back and forth across the yellow kitchen table, the coffee getting cold. The novel is committed to design. On this we agreed, you with your reverence for Joyce's Ulysses, your annual Bloomsday party, everyone invited to read a passage. Me with my impatience over his fussiness, my claims for Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald? You're comparing Fitzgerald to Joyce? We let that one lie on the table. Oh, yes, we fought, and not just over literature. But we could never seem, afterwards, to remember what our furies were about. You would walk out of the room, I would Hector. Come back here, you coward. I fretted over our fights. I wanted a perfect relationship. No, you said. Fights are good. They let you have these sweet reconciliations. Even a short novel has a trajectory. My point, and why you can compare Gatsby to Ulysses. Do you always have to get the last word? What I was trying to explain, the final page of any novel is a destination, the creation of form offering the illusion of inevitability, the denial of chaos. We don't love novels because they are like life, but because they are unlike it, deftly organized, filled with the satisfaction of shape. This shapeliness isn't closure, a modern comfort word, too airlessly psychological for the deep gratifications storytelling provides. The great carapace of the novel puts a bridle on the stampede of detail. And yet, the great unsorted pile of detail, that's what a life is. Not the organization of details into shape, that's the novel, but the recognition of the welter of life, note-taking, James's ineluctable consequence of one's greatest inward energy to take them as natural as to look, to think, to feel, to recognize, to remember. You understood, I think you did, that I didn't think of note-taking as material, bricks for the great architecture of a book, even if Henry James did. I was taking them for themselves. Life is not a story, a settled version. It's an unsorted heap of images we keep going through, the familiar snaps taken up and regarded, then tossed back, until unbidden they rise again, images that float to the surface of the mind, rise, fall, drift, and return only to drift away again in shadow. They never quite die, and they never achieve form. They are the makings of a life, not of a narrative. Not art, but life, trailing its poignant desire for art. Call them vignettes, these things we finger and drop again into their shoebox. We all have these snippets rolling around, not stories we tell, just photos that refuse to fade entirely away. These are the framed moments that decide a life, and are lost to art because they aren't complete, have no resolution. They're nothing much. Essay, vignettes, memoirs. The French words our stalwart, form-seeking Anglophone mind must borrow to articulate our formlessness. Deep winter as I sit here in our drafty old St. Paul house, the lunar white surface of the deepest season inviting vignettes into the mind, the ice cold of memory. These memory shards can even predate us. My earliest is more legacy than memory. Uncle Frankie, my father's older brother, adored hero son of the Czech granny, a blacksmith, such an antique profession, making his way as a semi-pro welterweight prize fighter. Frankie, of the dashing good looks, the idealism, promising his twin sister Lillian, my favorite aunt, a diamond ring if she would stay in high school and graduate while he, this is the Depression, gets a job. Frankie, killed in that terrible industrial accident in 1936. He'd been given a pickup job at Schmidt Brewery. He'd lost his railroad job in the layoffs of the Depression and was repairing a valve when someone, who, turned on the boiling water and it gushed in, sweeping him into the scalding whirlwind. He survived 3 weeks, conscious, knowing it was the end. I've put him in every book I've written, managed to wedge him in somehow or other, the lost hero, the good guy I never met. Did I make it up? Or is it true that he somehow grabbed hold of the ladder up and out of the giant copper vat, but slipped and splashed fatally back into the cauldron? I see it. I've always seen it. It was part of being in our family. I was given to believe that after the war, he would have been saved because of all the burn treatments developed then. So war was good in its way. We had to drop the bomb, darling. It saved lives. Frankie was gone, and therefore, even as a child, it felt like therefore. He was more present than anyone. The terrible decisive accident. I lost that diamond ring, Aunt Lillian said. I lost it. And you knew what she meant. The ring of relationship gone. From book to book, there always seemed to be a little something left over I had not described. So I pulled him in again with the new detail. The diamond ring, for example. I've never mentioned that till now. Maybe I'd forgotten it, but there it always was, and with it my aunt's face, not just sad, but remorseful, as if losing the ring had been part of the accident. A man called me after my first book was published, someone from the old Czech neighborhood. He had known Frankie, worked with him. He wanted to meet me, talk to me. I read your book, he said, giving the sense that this had taken considerable effort. We met in an old Art Deco bar, one now gentrified, but then, in the 1980s, fading into itself from the era he and Frankie had shared as young men. I want to tell you something, he said. He fussed around, ordered a beer, and showed me some newspaper clippings. I can't remember what they were about. I was, God help me, bored. He was old, of course, something of a gas bag. I wasn't sure he had actually read my book, after all. He said, all of West 7th, the main street of the Czech neighborhood by the brewery where my family lived, where I'd been born, was lined 4 deep from Schmidt's to St. Stan's, where the funeral was. Men with their hats off, women weeping, crying, right there on the street. Another detail I've never mentioned until now. The crowds on the street, mourning the working man hero, the handsome prize fighter. That was what he wanted to tell me, I figured. Give me that sense of importance. I thanked him, and though I saw that he would like to sit longer in the smoky room, I wanted to go. And I did. On to the next thing. Surely he's long gone by now, the old man stuffing his clippings into his coat pocket, ordering another beer, staying in the dim bar after I scurried away, glad to be free of him. Then last year he appeared again. Not him, but the rest of his message. I think that's what appeared. Another boring event. Another just-say-no occasion where I had shown up, done what was asked of me. You can count on me. And there I was at the Czech Hall where my grandparents had danced. I was supposed to read an excerpt about the old neighborhood from my first book, one I never read from anymore, the one the old man had wanted to talk about. The program, devoted to the working-class history of St. Paul, was organized by the State Historical Society. 6 people engaged in family history projects were making presentations, one after another, unused to public speaking, yammering away. Yet another way to lose an evening of life, sitting there, listening, pretending to listen, making to-do lists in my head. I was second to last on the program. Read my couple of pages, sat down, waiting for it to be over. Just one more person to go. An older woman with a bad hip shagging up to the front to report on her father, a blacksmith many years dead. She displayed a photograph, a long horizontal print crowded with working men outside the old Great Northern Railway shops. The names of the men were on the back, she said, and she began reading them off. Good Lord, this is never going to end. Tears of boredom forming in the corners of my eyes. Frank Hampel, she read, the name leaping out of her litany like a reprimand. I went up to her afterward, asked to see the photo, knowing I couldn't possibly pick him out of the group. My eye went right to him, the family laser beam latching. He looked tough and romantic, a young Johnny Depp, a tender bruiser. Hollywood in that face, one of those fuck-you-love-me faces of the bad boy lead. You know, the woman said shyly, they say it wasn't an accident. I stared at her. The hideous fall into the boiling vat of water, the poor guy, as my father always added, who hadn't realized Frankie was down there, he had to live with that. The accident. He was very prominent in the union, you know, this daughter of a brother blacksmith was saying as we both stared at the historical photo. Very big in the union effort. Some thought it wasn't no accident. The dim deco bar, the man cramming old clippings in his jacket pocket. I have something I want to tell you. If I had stayed for his story instead of just tossing the vignette in the beaten-up shoebox of memory, well, we'll never know now, will we? Was he in possession of this vignette, the telling moment? Or was he? Was it possible? Was he? The poor guy? Live with it. Live with never knowing. Plenty to ponder. Nothing, finally, to narrate. This is life, not art. The welter of images, the absence of a controlling narrative, life itself in its disarray being life, refusing to be tidied into a story, and then the story refusing to be refused, protesting formlessness, insisting on resolution, on shape. I'll never write about Frankie again. He isn't a vignette anymore. And never again can it be an accident. Now, warm in our winter house, another vignette comes flickering forward as the light fades tonight. One I never told you, which is strange given the subject, given that I told you everything, sometimes over and over again. Crazy about you. Just crazy about you. This one is mine and not an inheritance. Midwinter, a Saturday afternoon at the Olympic, the skating rink across the street from the house where I grew up. The day is gray. A piercing cold safeguards the freshly flooded ice, keeps it hard. We skate on the cloudy glass, barely nicked by the early skaters, of which, as always, I am one. This is years before the heart-thumping Friday nights when I will hyperventilate over whether Tommy Howe or Billy McGahan or someone will ask me to skate with him. My Arctic entry into erotic life is years ahead, but it will always have something of ice in it. This is still childhood. We're skating separately, boys zigzagging on their blunt hockey skates, practicing slap shots with their sticks, girls treading along in white boots whose slim blades have toe picks that look as if the metal were cut with pinking shears. We skate, five girls in a row holding hands. What will we do when we grow up? This is our subject. We glide round and round. Carol Barta says, I'm going to have five children, same as my mom. Joyce O'Neill is quick with her own showy number. 10, she says tartly, at 9, already a Catholic matron who will take her chances with the rhythm method. I'm a crack skater, an accomplishment I wear with feigned modesty. I'm on the ice every day practicing relentlessly. I would like skating lessons, but my father says, no, I will stick with the piano. We can only afford one extra. I can pull myself into a tight column, spinning like a wand without falling in a dizzy heap, cutting the ice backward, pivoting forward, fearless in my turns and jumps, executing swan dives, and the rarely attempted shoot the duck that involves a crouch, speeding on one skate. All this I do. Even backwards I do this. Other skaters stop and watch me. Sometimes they cheer. I pretend not to notice, pretend to be skating just for the pleasure of it. And it is a pleasure, though also it is this other thing. My cold little star glows inwardly, all faces turn toward me. But right now, I'm just skating like everybody else, round and round the perfect ice with my friends as they announce their futures. I'm on the outside taking broader strides than anyone else in the line as we round the curve near the warming house. Katie Masters will enter the convent, she says gravely, trumping everyone and bringing things to a momentary silence. Eileen McPherson, a sensible girl, soldiers on. She has decided on two, a boy first and a girl. She speaks with satisfaction, as of something nicely settled. My turn. They're waiting for me, the big talker, to ante up. What is my number? Always vying for first place. Will I join Katie Masters in the convent? Confusion seizes me. Panic flutters in a zigzag neural pattern from brain to stomach and back again. An inner fizz of distress spreads everywhere. This is mixed up with something else I can't locate, though it's even worse. Much later, I recognize this other thing as shame, an emotion unfamiliar to me in my easy glory as a beloved child with good girl bona fides, boring Father Kennedy and even myself with a tedious grocery list of low-grade repetitive sins toted up for confession on Saturday nights. I drop Eileen's hand, fending off suffocation, and peel away in a showy flourish. No one thinks this odd. We form brief skating lines and then sail off alone or go to the warming house for hot chocolate. The ice is free space, and everyone knows I like to skate fast. Off on my own. But what is this? What's happening? Why must I run away from this cheerful game? Why can't I sing out how many children will be mine in the gauzy phantasm of the future we love to inhabit? I know why. Also, I don't know. That is, I know what it is. But I'm baffled by why it is. Zero. That's my number. That's how many children I will have. This is not a wish, not a decision. It's not even a bravura abdication of the sort Katie Masters has announced. It is a recognition. This seed of self, unitary and vacant, is dead center, the moon-colored essence of my fate. It has announced itself at this icy moment, and without my permission, age 10, winter all around me, and zero is my number. Why is that my number? I don't know, but it is. I skate away, take to the ice. I shoot the duck. I rise again and lift my outstretched leg in a perfectly executed swan dive, winging my arms out, my head up to the blank sky. I do my tricks. I don't understand what has happened, but that it has happened, that I know. It is a framed moment, not a story, but something much smaller, a spark of meaning I will return to all my life, the DNA of identity, what, much later, I learn is a vignette, a photo frayed at the edges, its old silver frame stowed in the dark attic of the mind. A bare fragment of story, caught in the sticky amber of recollection. It isn't even a subject. It's the threshold of a subject, a necessary opening to a wider interior to be explored, considered, read like the book it wants to become. It is something insubstantial, made substantial sheerly by virtue of its indelibility. A vignette shifts the mind away from storytelling into speculation. Why? Why? A bit of narrative sand irritating itself into a pearl of thought, an essay in the making. The vignette is the construction site for a palace of values, a hand-built habitation, well-sited with views and loggias, stately gathering rooms and odd, intimate nooks. It leads down the rabbit hole of thought, not to the taut wire of narrative. And this, on the smooth surface of our home ice, is my first. But is it art? It is not. It's life. That's all. The sand grit that works its way under the shell of the self. There are so many shifting sands, glinting in the winter light, the moments that make a life, though not, alas, a story. Summer now, and I'm sitting at Vlasta's table, the formica rectangle wedged between the tiny dark kitchen and the window along the scant passageway, another alleged room in this jigsaw apartment. A heavy drape with a jungle design hangs on a rod and serves as a door to the bath just behind my chair. Nothing is wasted here. Every inch has a purpose, brought smartly forward for its moment, then falling back in formation until called up again. For now, this corridor serves as dining room. When Vlasta doesn't have us out walking or hiking in the wine country of South Moravia, this is where I am every late July, at her table, taking in her perfect meals as if they too were a trek we embark on, hour after hour, moving slowly in place over the cuisine of the region she commands as surely as she knows the land, the vineyards, the forest trails. Restaurants are out of the question, foolishly expensive, and that food? No, no, no. Put that credit card away. It won't be long before the flower-patterned platters start emerging from the closet kitchen. For now, I'm supposed to keep sipping Bekarovka from one of her mother's Moser liqueur glasses, the cut glass incised so sharply it seems it would nick your finger if you didn't handle it carefully. But you, that is I, want to do everything carefully, gently here. It's the point of being at her table. Rush has left the room. Food has slowed the pulse. Pavarotti comes forward again. One of the very nicest things about life is the way we must regularly stop whatever it is we are doing and devote our attention to eating. Gauze curtains over the window barely obscure, outside, ranks of the same kind of building we're in, what the Czechs call panelaki, panel buildings. Dour construction dating from the socialist era, slabs of cheaply made high-rises for workers to live in or be warehoused. To be fair, these apartment complexes in Znojmo, a provincial South Moravian capital near the Austrian border, are less dismal than the taller high-rises of the Minneapolis West Bank, where recently arrived Somalis now make their homes, turning that early 20th century Scandinavian immigrant enclave of cottages and kitchen gardens into a neighborhood of halal markets. Modernism for the masses is aging in place everywhere, its proud reach now a bleak supplication to high heaven, a hopeful, if arrogant, architecture. Its ideal lives on in its ragged reality, rising, yet sagging somehow, on both sides of what was for so long the essential opposition of my lifetime, East, West. Znoimos Panalaki offer more cheer now than the aging Minneapolis high-rises. The cheap windows here have been replaced with triple-glazed insets. The elevators are sleek and assured. These buildings, once the gloom gray of the socialist color wheel, brown, gray, tarnish black, have been rouged up and wink in ice cream pastels. Velasta's building is banana yellow. She owns her own apartment. Private ownership is back. Whereas the Minneapolis buildings are public housing rentals, a reversal of Cold War economic patterns. I've been returning these recent summers to Vlasta's apartment, driving from Prague to Znojmo with my friend and hers, Anna, a cardiologist and public health doctor I met in Prague right after the end of the Cold War. The two of them are hiking buddies, mad trekkers, mushroom hunters, knowers of forest lore, hardy campers, both aging out of the endurance hikes that brought them together years ago, but still game. I often have to stop on our hikes, pretending I'm taking in the view while they soldier on. In fact, I'm gasping to catch my breath. I know why I return. Not for one of my subjects, though this year I plan to seek out another of my monastic heroes. Not you and your nuns this time, but me and my monk, Gregor Mendel. The pea plant man, you said, puzzled, when I first proposed him as one of my exemplars of leisure. Why not Linnaeus, you said. If I was thinking about a life given over to the Pacific naming and ordering of the floral world, the innocent age of science, wouldn't Linnaeus be my man? After all, as I'd told you, my florist father thought of naming me Linnea. But no, I'll get to that, darling. Remember your post-it note attached to the clipping about the 25th anniversary of Prague's Velvet Revolution? What about how leisure fits in with the Cold War? Didn't you say something about that at dinner? A connection? Discuss. You're the one who Googled, on a hunch, the date of Churchill's Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri, March 5th, 1946. 7 days before you were born. How pleased you were with that bit of research, making world history part of my lifeline. But beyond Gregor Mendel, what I'm looking for is right here at this small table, the Moser liqueur glass fracturing light onto the embroidered placemat, the meticulous work of Vlasta's long-dead mother, the linen starched, iron solid as plywood, yellow thread flowers with their green vine as perfect on the reverse as on the front. Care and tending, the art of domesticity. The art of gardening, too, Gregor Mendel's art. The force field of private life, facing off against history's hammer and sickle. Vlasta and Anna have lived their lives, except this coda we're in now, on the colder side of the Cold War. Yet here, I keep finding, is warmth, curiously missing in America, after all. The meal will be served in courses by pixie-like Vlasta, never-married Vlasta, who cared for her father and mother until they finally left the planet in their 90s. She's well into her 70s, small, pert head, precise movements, an operating room nurse's sense of order, though in fact she worked as a shop assistant in a state-owned hardware store. She lives now on a pension no American graduate student could imagine surviving on. Even Anna, who who was not favored under communism and has not thrived under the new market economy, shakes her head in wonder. How does Vlasta manage? Light on her feet, quick, exact. An artist of the day, snapping her perfectly laundered linens on our guest cots, practically saluting from her high command on the battlement of the beautiful meal. Reed thin, an aerial of the dumpling, sprite of a melting pork roast, beef svichkova, limpid in its cream and tart berry sauce. And much to be said about the astonishing reincarnations she resurrects from cabbage, and pastries so airy they seem about to levitate off the faded china platter. This is the food of my Czech grandmother, who left this region at the end of the 19th century and became a cook for the rich in St. Paul. Same food, same deft touch, same tricksy spirit. Paradoxically, the same ability to purvey luxury out of poverty. Leisure, we tend to think, belongs to wealth. Its ease is a result or symptom of success, a sign of an excess of riches. It's what you get when you've clawed your way, or your father or your grandfather did, to the top. Didn't the Romans, with their otium cum dignitate, require a slave class to do the heavy lifting to assure their life under the grape arbors? Hasn't history always relied on the toil of designated classes or castes to let it be a civilization? The shame of it, the cost of leisure being someone else's hard labor and broken body. My grandmother's bowed legs. Rickets, my father said, frowning, when I asked about her cartoonish stance. My grandmother must have sensed the latent shame of the nobles, as she called the people she first served as a girl in Europe. Later in America, still a girl, becoming a culinary wizard who cooked for the rich, the word she used, as we did, to indicate her employers with amused, even affectionate contempt. We always had the sense around her table that we were having more fun. Being us was better than being them. There was something slightly ridiculous about being rich. In a college sociology course, we were asked to name our socioeconomic class. Working class? Middle class. Upper middle class? Wealth. Which had just that one word, wealth, apparently lifted above class categories in a range of its own. These were the choices. I was stumped. Finally, I wrote, I still think accurately. Serving class. After her, the next generation of women, her daughters, my aunts, childless stay-at-home wives who cooked for their uxorious husbands, whose lunch pails they outfitted with snugly wrapped sandwiches, scratch-baked slices of cake, a thermos of coffee. My Irish mother, a working woman, her proud term for her file clerk job, who married into this food-obsessed clan, was aghast at all this effort. She was glad, she said, to be born in the frozen food age. I first came to Czechoslovakia, as it was then, during the Cold War, because of this Czech grandmother, the iconic Czech novel, is Babička, Granny. The domestic goddess of the 19th century Czech Romantic movement, a touchstone not simply of family, but of the nation, the familiar grandmother figure as a stealth political operative with her knedlíky and kolačky. But even if my own Czech granny was part of my urgency in getting here, oddly enough, I didn't seek out her past once I arrived. It was not she, after all, who first brought me here, but an unexpected collision with history. Get me in the world! August 20th, 1968, just past 11 p.m., Eddie Hadro, city editor of the St. Paul Pioneer Press, is jabbing his pencil in my direction. He does this every night about this time, the pencil a dart he's aiming from his outstretched arm. The newsroom is straight out of Front Page, bottles of rye stowed in reporters' desk drawers, an old-timer with a cigarette drooping stereotypically from his lip, writing up the police blotter. Ash falls on his faux silk tie as he rolls a sheet of grainy copy paper over the platen of his royal. Head cocked, snugging the telephone receiver to his shoulder, he's growling, "Yeah, yeah, I got that. But spell the last name. Some Polak." The rat-a-tat-tat of dusty typewriters, furious swearing when a key sticks, though only the sports writers in the back by the morgue say, "Fuck," pronounced in lowered sacramental tones. They mutter an apology if a girl, not yet a woman, is passing by. But everybody, girls and men alike, curses with relish in the newsroom as nobody then swore in public. "Damn, shit. Hell no. Bet your ass." In the night newsroom, the practitioners of journalism, sliced into the guts of language as sure as surgeons opening up the hidden parts of the body. We talked dirty. It was a professional thing. My first job out of college. A job I almost didn't get, because working the night desk meant that at the end of the shift, like everybody else sitting around the horseshoe desk writing headlines and editing copy, I would have to walk in the dark to my car, loaned by my mother, who worked days as a file clerk at a college library. A girl walking alone downtown past 2 a.m.? Reason to be passed over. I was given the job finally because several of the men on the desk, middle-aged with children close to my age, had said sure they'd walk the girl to her car. "Will someone be waiting up for you at home?" the managing editor asked me. How it was in 1968 in St. Paul. And how I came to be charged with the news of the world, a boxed quarter page above the fold inside page one, over the ads. This tidy box, edited from UPI or AP wire dispatches, usually took care of most matters beyond St. Paul. Eddie Hadro signaled with his pencil around 11 p.m. before the copy boy came back with the damp sandwiches from Digidio's, and off I trotted, a well-trained retriever. Like a small-time bookie, Eddie Hadro actually wore a green visor and black sleeve protectors he peeled off at the end of the night. Actually, because it all seems unreal now, the way the past does when it comes back in the sureness of its abandoned details. I walked over to the glassed-in room behind us that housed the UPI and AP teletypes. Were these two gray metal machines in this sequestered space behind a glass door because they made a lot of noise? Or because they were, in spite of their bulk, terribly delicate mechanisms that required a sterile ICU? It wasn't clear. But entering the room was a step away from St. Paul, away from the littleness of our concerns, a tiptoe into the vast workings of the world. Inside this isolation booth, there was no swearing, no furious Xing out of copy, no yellow copy paper reeled onto pitted platens, no impatient slam of carriage returns. Just the relentless stamping out of disembodied sentences in a rote rhythm unlike real writing. This auto-dictation emanated from a disembodied correspondent way out there somewhere, the world itself sending its implacable communiques from its Olympian remove. Sometimes the world did overtake St. Paul and claimed the front page. A lot had happened in the 6 months I'd been working at the paper. LBJ had announced he would not run again for president. We had to remake the front page that night. Martin Luther King was murdered, but that happened before Eddie Hadro had made up page one, so doing the banner headline posed no problem. Then, in June, another hard knock from the world. Bobby Kennedy, in California, was shot. Given the two-hour time difference past deadline, so to speak, another front page to be reset. A deep rivalist pleasure, The Minneapolis Tribune didn't get the story in time. But this late August night was quiet, the world apparently on vacation. Europe is asleep, I sometimes thought with a kind of awe as I opened the glass door to the machines. Except for Vietnam, where we had no business, to me, the world was Europe. I spent my days off, clean for Jean, campaigning for Eugene McCarthy. Of course, I was against the war and hated Hubert Humphrey, to my parents' dismay. How could I be against Hubert? He'd beat the Dixiecrats. I closed the door behind me and approached the UPI machine, positioned against the back wall, silent and broody in its glass room. How long did I stand there? It could not have been long, but a spacious caesura of time as I waited before the bulky machine, looking through the cloudy glass, over the roll of gray paper poised for it to say something. And then it spoke, a Ouija board spelling out its occult message. To me, alone, locked in our seance. Prague, August 21, 1968, UPI. Invasion forces from Russia and its satellites occupied Czechoslovakia with troops, tanks, and jet planes against sporadic resistance today and snuffed out the country's experiment in liberal reform. Street fighting in Prague left some dead and wounded as thousands of Czechoslovaks surged into the streets and shouted defiance of the invaders. Cannon, machine gun, and small arms fire crashed and rattled through the night in the capital and in Bratislava, where 2 weeks ago the Russians agreed to let Czechoslovakia have its liberal regime. Except I wasn't reading the dispatch in these complete sentences and paragraphs. The machine had a peculiar tick, clearing its mechanical throat before speaking. It whirred and clicked in place for a moment as if deliberating how to say what it had to say. Then the letters began to jerk in staccato onto the soft gray paper, pausing now and again and jolting forward again. Standing there, I had the sensation not of reading a written report, but of watching it being composed before my widening eyes from a great, impenetrable distance. The first word, the dateline, Prague, startled me even before the rest came tapping out. Prague, where my family had come from. My grandmother, the Czech peasant, whose letters in English I began ghostwriting in grade school as soon as I commanded cursive. My first freelance job. Prague, I understood, was not part of the world. It was out of the running as a location. We called it, as my grandmother did, the old country. A former place. Anyway, it was unreachable. Prague was behind the Iron Curtain. A metaphor so profound it was not a figure of speech, but a feature of landscape more real than the forests and mountains that divided Bohemia from West Germany, Moravia from Austria. News of Dubček and the Prague Spring had penetrated this iron impasse, and it seemed there was going to be something called socialism with a human face. But on this August night, standing alone as the invasion of Czechoslovakia jittered onto the gray paper, what mattered was that I knew something of the world, that no one else in St. Paul, not even Eddie Hadro, knew. I tore the sheet from the machine, walked out of the glass room to the city desk, past the slot man in charge of the copy desk. I held out the UPI dispatch to Eddie Hadro. As he reached for it, I said, "We're going to have to remake page one." This, in a voice of authority, I had never before possessed in the newsroom, or anywhere else for that matter. I had Eddie Hadro's full attention, another first. "The Russians have invaded Prague," I said neutrally, a woman privy to the secret movement of troops and the intentions of empire, standing tall before this local working stiff in his green visor, as I offloaded intel from my position behind enemy lines. In my hand, I held the world. Was that the moment that I decided I must go there, behind the Iron Curtain? It wasn't really a decision, more a response to a call. Listen to your inner voice, children. It will guide you. That stern invitation to follow the directives of the inner self is the deepest, most enduring aspect of a Catholic childhood. The sovereignty of it, the command given over to the still unformed child, the power of it. It's a more decisive legacy than the much-invoked Catholic guilt I'm often told I suffer from as from a congenital illness, a judgment offered with amused certainty by almost complete strangers. It took some years after that August night to get there, to follow the inner voice. Graduate school, poetry instead of journalism, another inner voice directive. Then back working in journalism again. But in 1975, I quit a good editing job, everyone said, at the local public radio station. With a marine blue backpack meant for tenting in the boundary waters humped on my back, and the cheapest transatlantic ticket I could find, Winnipeg to London, and then by boat train, as the old novels put it, to the continent. I finally reached Heb, the Czech border town featuring a rickety Cold War guard tower right out of an early Le Carré novel. I was behind the Iron Curtain. I had never been anywhere before. Canada didn't count. I was going to Czechoslovakia to find my roots. I was fascinated or dogged by what I thought of as the lingering life of immigration, the idea that just because my family had left Europe, they weren't entirely in or of America. Maybe I wasn't either. This in spite of the fact that I didn't speak Czech, and American English was not only my native language, but my métier. I considered myself a writer. I was pretty much alone in this belief, but I didn't care. I didn't trust anyone over 30. I trusted my inner voice. I was making my way. Hot damn, as the guys on the night desk would say. Some burr of the old world had stuck to me as I walked through my family life. The immigrants themselves were dying off. Grandmothers, grandfathers of the great immigration, spanning the 19th and early 20th centuries, taking with them their languages and foreign, fading memories, leaving behind a few recipes and stray words. At home, we called beer pivo, and potatoes were brambori. Alex Haley's Roots came out in 1976. I remember being startled by the title, the very word I used, I thought privately, to describe my own impulse to go back to Prague the year before, in 1975. Seeking your roots was in the air of the mid-70s. To locate whatever there was still there, not only for the descendants of slaves, but those of serfs, peasants, whatever we would have been in our various versions of whichever old country our genetic code hailed from. In my case, the serving class. How strange, then, that I never searched out my grandmother's village, never sought my grandfather's people. I'd absorbed, without realizing it, the fact that roots are not meant to be found. They're buried. Anyway, my roots were deep enough in St. Paul. Where else? It was the great world I was lugging my blue backpack to find, not some long-lost relative. But once past Heb, on the dismal train to the smudged gold of Prague, I had stepped through the looking glass, not into the great world as I had longed for it on the night desk of the Pioneer Press. This was the other world, the other side, our opposite, our opposition. It was what I had left my editing job to see, not, after all, the